The Chinese have an expression that you kill a chicken to scare the monkeys, and in a sense, we're the chicken.
Canada makes a diplomatic change amid tensions with China. It's Monday, January 28th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. Find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Thailand has announced long-awaited elections, Australia's controversial celebration, the U.S. government reopens, frozen embryos in limbo, and the link between color and taste. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday fired his country's ambassador to China. This a week after the controversy over statements the ambassador made about the extradition of a Chinese citizen to the United States. Trudeau announced in a statement that he had asked for and accepted the resignation of John McCallum without specifying the reason for McCallum's exit. McCallum made headlines Tuesday when he discussed the high-profile extradition case of Chinese citizen Meng Wanzhou, arrested in December in Vancouver, to the United States. VOA Asia's Ira Melman discussed the case with Colin Robertson, vice president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. He asked about the comments Ambassador McCallum made that cost him his job.
He suggested that Meng Wanzhou, the Huawei executive who is under extradition hearings in Canada, would have a good defense because of comments made earlier by President Trump in which he suggested that perhaps there could be a deal worked out with China around Huawei and other, by which relating to the bigger China-U.S. trade dispute under which Ms. Meng Wanzhou, who is, of course, the senior executive in Huawei and in a sense a princess in China, could be released.
Does the firing indicate to you how tenuous this situation is?
Well, I think that at a time of crisis, and I think there is a crisis right now in Canada-China relations, sparked by first the extradition, then the detainment of the two Canadians, Mr. Spavor and Mr. Kovrig, in I think are fairly difficult circumstances, as well as the changing sentence of a convicted drug smuggler from 15 years to execution, that and the Chinese have taken a couple of other steps relating to tourism coming to Canada and warn Chinese to be careful about coming to Canada, and we've had to put out a similar kind of approach, that it is a difficult time, and I think that the ambassadors are basically there to be both voice, to listen, and to accurately represent the views of their government. In the case of Mr. McCallum, that no longer held true. The Canadian government, Prime Minister Trudeau, and our Foreign Minister, Chrystia Freeland, have been steadfast in making the argument that the extradition request from the United States to Canada is a rule of law issue in which the government, the political side, does not interfere. It will run its course on that separate sphere. It's a bit like separation of powers in the United States with the legislative, executive, and judicial branch all separate. And the Chinese, of course, have a different approach. Everything falls under the lead of the Chinese Communist Party and the president. So they have been trying to convince us to release Madame Meng Wanzhou and therefore, in a sense, break our trust in the norms and the rule of law that Canada holds dearly. And it's one of our great values. And so I think for that reason that the Prime Minister felt there was we had to make a change, that the Chinese would no longer trust John McCallum, even though he had been a former cabinet minister, but he had departed from where the Canadian government has been not just once but twice, and that was one time too many. And so now we'll have to find a new ambassador. I think at the same time that it offers an opportunity to reset the relationship, but I think we should also ask for a new Chinese ambassador because the current Chinese ambassador to Canada has accused the Canadian government of white supremacy and he's made comments which ambassadors should not make. And I think that as the ambassadors are effectively the quarterback in the field, as they say, the eyes, the ears, and the voice for the host government, we probably need two new quarterbacks because the situation until the resignation of Mr. McCallum is that the Chinese probably weren't going to trust Mr. McCallum anymore, and we certainly don't trust the Chinese ambassador to Canada.
How much does what McCallum had to say, does it reflect the population's view in Canada?
Well, his comment that we hope that this will work its way through one way or the other, I think that his comment about the president's comments as being will be part of the defense, the arguments why she should not be extradited to the United States, I think that is most Canadians and American commentators have made this comment as well, and I think that the president's comments were certainly not one that you would expect from a president of the United States around a legal matter regarding extradition. So I think you park that, but certainly that is going to be used by her legal team in making the case, their case, before the Canadian federal judge, who will have to consider the request from the U.S. government that will be presented by a couple of Canadian Department of Justice officials to the judge. And we'll see how that plays out.
Colin, anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
No, I just think that this the whole China the China-Canada relationship is now being affected, is having an effect on the Canada-U.S. relationship, and so Canadians, in many ways, feel that they are kind of a proxy for Chinese frustration with the United States over the bigger issue of the Canada-U.S. trade dispute. And Canada has become caught in this, and I think the China feel in some ways that the Chinese are taking out their frustrations on Canada, and also the Chinese have an expression that you kill a chicken to scare the monkeys, and in a sense we're the chicken.
Colin Robertson, Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, he was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Twin bombs hit Philippines cathedral, dozens dead and hurt. Australia demands release of author detained in China. Ahok case highlights Indonesia's blasphemy law. In poor Cambodian town, a job in South Korea changes lives. Djokovic dominates Nadal to capture 7th Australian Open. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories with photos, videos, and much more when you go to Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. After almost 5 years after the military stormed to power in yet another coup, Thailand has finally announced an official election date. It comes in the wake of mounting defiance of the army's tight control. David Boyle joins us with this report from Bangkok.
The three-finger salute, a forbidden symbol of resistance under Thailand's junta that can land you in army custody for some attitude adjustment, as the military leaders call it. Though under the watchful eye of police, these protesters don't seem to care. They're fired up waiting for an election almost 5 years after the military seized power in a coup. On Wednesday, their calls were finally answered when Thailand's Election Commission announced the long wait was over.
The date of the general election is officially set on Sunday, 24th of March. That is the date which is flexible enough and should be beneficial to everyone concerned.
Until very recently, political activities like these had been completely banned by Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha. Many who have dared challenged his rule have wound up in jail, though activists have felt increasingly emboldened of late to test those waters. Prayut overthrew the Putai government of Yingluck Chinawat, the brother of Thaksin Shinawat, who himself was also removed as PM by the military. Parties aligned to Thaksin have won every Thai election since 2001, but the military has justified its autocratic interventions to restore stability during violent protests and control corruption. It's generated deep anger within Thaksin's base of supporters, who have taken out their frustration over the repeatedly delayed elections at rallies like these. Their opponents, the royalists, see things differently. Outside the Election Commission announcement, they were quick to stage a tiny protest opposing the date on the grounds that it comes too close to King Maha Vajiralongkorn's May coronation. The two sides have been locked in a bitter struggle for decades in a country that has seen 19 attempted coups, 12 successful, since 1932. A new force, Future Forward, has emerged, hoping to break that cycle, though they are under no illusions about how long Thailand's road to lasting democracy might be.
So if you want to correct what's wrong over the past decade, there's only one way you have, there's only one way you can solve that. You tackle the root cause of the problems. That means you have to deal with this structure, with this group of people. I haven't seen any politicians trying to do this before.
Whoever wins the March election will be legally bound by a junta-drafted 20-year development plan that covers everything from national security to social equality. A 250-seat Senate will also be handpicked by the military, which continues to threaten to use its sweeping constitutional powers against political opponents. It's the price the junta has exacted for a vote, and these activists have little choice but to pay. David Boyle for VOA News, Bangkok.
Happening now in Asia, two bombs minutes apart tore through a Roman Catholic cathedral on a southern Philippine island where Muslim militants are active, killing at least 20 people and wounding 111 others during a Sunday mass. Army troops and police posted outside were rushing in when the second bomb went off. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today as we all begin another week on VOA Asia. Indigenous groups are renewing their efforts to change the date of Australia Day. January 26th has been the traditional date for a national holiday commemorating the arrival of European settlers more than 230 years ago. But many Aboriginal people believe it marks a time when their lands were stolen and their communities pushed into poverty and disadvantage that persists to this day. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia Day stirs a heated debate about cultural identity and history. Many Indigenous people refer to January 26 as Invasion Day, when in 1788, the first fleet of British ships arrived in Sydney Harbour. There is a campaign to change the date. May 9 is one suggestion, to acknowledge when Australia's federal parliament first sat in 1901. Brooke Boney, the first Indigenous TV presenter on Australia's popular Today programme, believes the current date is insensitive.
I can't separate the 26th of January from the fact that my brothers are more likely to go to jail than they are to go to school, or that my little sisters and my mum are more likely to be beaten and raped than anyone else's sisters or mum. And that started from that day. So for me, it's a difficult day and I don't want to celebrate it. That's the day that it changed for us, you know? That's the sort of the beginning of what some people would say is the end. That's the turning point.
Despite a vocal campaign, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison has no plans to change the date of Australia Day. He has, though, said there could be another national holiday to recognise Aboriginal culture.
Australia Day is the 26th of January. That was the day that Australia's course changed forever. It was 60,000 years of Indigenous history before that, and modern Australia effectively started on that day. You can't change that. That's just what happened. That's just a fact. And I want Australia Day to be even more so a day where all Australians can come together. And so I am open to a chat with the Australian people about how we can better acknowledge Indigenous Australians and our Indigenous peoples.
For many Australians, their National Day is a time to celebrate their modern history with barbecues, concerts and camel races. More than half of all Australians participate in events organised by state governments, local councils and community groups. Over 16,000 migrants become citizens on Australia Day. It's been celebrated since 1935. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, the U.S. Congress and President Trump come to an agreement to put the government back in business. But will it last? You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Beijing says it is investigating a Chinese-Australian writer for alleged involvement in criminal activities endangering national security. In Australia, a prominent government MP is demanding that the author be freed immediately. Officials in Beijing say the Australian national is being questioned on suspicion of espionage. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, we look at the business of the U.S. federal government, which is now officially back in business, for now. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history ended Friday when President Donald Trump delayed his demand for funding for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, signing a three-week spending bill that reopens shuttered agency and gets back pay to 800,000 federal workers. But as VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, the short-term funding is meant to buy lawmakers time to address border security.
Air travel delayed along the east coast of the United States as unpaid air traffic controllers call out from work. The same day a second paycheck is missed by federal employees after two failed attempts in the U.S. Senate to reopen the government. That was the critical mass needed to move President Trump to reopen the government through February 15th, but without border wall funding.
Over the next 21 days, I expect that both Democrats and Republicans will operate in good faith. This is an opportunity for all parties to work together for the benefit of our whole beautiful, wonderful nation.
21 days for federal employees to get paid and for lawmakers to negotiate a border security deal the president was clear must still include that wall.
The walls we are building are not medieval walls. They are smart walls. We do not need 2,000 miles of concrete wall from sea to shiny sea. We never did. We never proposed that.
Trump's agreement to reopen the government to discuss border security was the demand from Democrats throughout the history-making 36-day standoff.
The American people do not like it when you throw a wrench into the lives of government workers over an unrelated political dispute. Hopefully now the president has learned his lesson.
Republican leadership called for Democrats to honor those demands.
I hope our Democratic friends will stay true to the commitment they've stated constantly over the past weeks, that once government was reopened, they'd be perfectly willing to negotiate in good faith on a full year government funding that would include a significant investment in urgently needed border security measures, including physical barriers.
But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made it clear Democrats' essential position against funding a wall has not changed.
But our unity is our power, and that is what maybe the president underestimated.
Trump weighed declaring a national emergency at the border to obtain the funds for a wall. He later warned that was still a possibility if negotiations don't work out.
We're going to work with the Democrats, we're going to see. And if we can't do that, then we'll do... Obviously, we're going to do the emergency because that's what it is. It's a national emergency.
A sign progress on the ongoing immigration debate is only temporary. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
This news from VOA Asia. Australian Open title goes to Serbian tennis star Novak Djokovic. His seventh title in Melbourne came at the expense of Spaniard Rafael Nadal in straight sets, 6-3, 6-2, 6-3. It was the third straight Grand Slam championship for the top-seeded Djokovic, who has now won a total of 15 major titles. These and many other stories are on VOA Asia Facebook. Now in VOA Asia, infertile couples who want to have a child may decide to use a technology called IVF, or in vitro fertilization. It's an invasive and expensive procedure in which eggs are retrieved from the woman and sperm from the man combined in the lab, where the hope is that fertilization will occur. At that point, the embryos may be transferred to the woman's womb. But now many couples choose to freeze most of the embryos. They can test them for health problems and transfer the most viable one at a time to avoid multiple births. That often means that some are left over once the desired family is complete. And as VOA's Faith Lapidus reports, there are questions about what to do with them.
The joy of motherhood is balanced by Jenny Salmon's misgivings about the fate of the leftover embryos she's had in storage for 15 years after going through in vitro fertilization.
When I'm looking at the paperwork and thinking about what to do, I think about people and the potential for people, and that they're my living daughters who I love very much.
Tens of thousands, perhaps more than 1 million frozen embryos are in limbo, because couples can't decide what to do with them, whether to donate them or have them destroyed. Even if couples decide what to do in advance, a successful pregnancy can change perspectives, says health psychologist Andrea Braverman.
It's not hard to imagine that feelings can change when you have this hypothetical embryo, one of them turned into your very real child, and that may generate other thoughts and feelings about those other remaining embryos.
Some couples make no choice. They just quit paying storage fees, which can run to hundreds of dollars a year. Many fertility clinics do not destroy these abandoned embryos for fear they'll be sued while making an effort to track down the missing owners. Researchers think 5 to 7% of frozen embryos are abandoned, though it's as high as 18% at some clinics, including the one run by Dr. Craig Sweet in Florida.
These embryos are really frozen solid, and so they're not aging, that they probably will live for centuries.
He now requires patients to agree not to destroy them and founded an international donation program for people who want to use the leftover embryos that patients have agreed to donate.
Some of them will not make it.
But trying to decide what to do can be paralyzing.
I'm not going to have any more children. The possibility of needing them just in case, it doesn't apply to me any longer.
Yet, Samus continues to pay storage fees. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Did you know that tastes and colors can go hand in hand? They can, as VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
We know that certain colors can influence how a food product should taste. Like when we're about to drink a yellow-colored beverage, many of us probably think we're about to taste something tart like lemonade. Penn State University researchers Molly Higgins and John Hayes wanted to find out how people learn to associate colors with tastes and whether they could be taught to link colors with completely different tastes. Over 4 sessions, the researchers got subjects to sip liquids with new colors they had specifically selected, avoiding any preconceived color taste pairings. Then the subjects were given uncolored liquids and were asked to pair each flavor with the new colors. It turns out the subjects picked the correct color taste match 59% of the time. The research will be published in the journal Food Quality and Preference. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And be sure to catch more of Rick Pantaleo's reports on our website at voanews.com. Science in a Minute, you know, only takes a minute. We'd love to hear from you. Why don't you write to us? voaasia@voanews.com is our email address. You can also reach us via Facebook at VOA Asia Facebook. And as always, we invite you to stop by our website. That's voanews.com. You can also hear us on the radio. Many great radio stations across Asia carry our program, like PSU Radio Pattani FM 107.25 at Prince of Songkla University in Thailand. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. As always, we thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Aidan Utku, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day.